session number 21658, room 2.
Tony Colgan, Real 2.
We were took up four positions, and we were in a. I was actually mounted the mortar in a bomb hole. It was quite a deep hole, I suppose, something like about 5 or 6 foot deep, and about 12 foot across. So it must have been some big bomb that dropped there. And we were there for a day or two, and I found a nice little level spot in this bomb hole, and I unrolled my bedding on there and went to sleep there, only to find out that it was actually level because it was just been tamped off as a grave for a German soldier. So I moved the next night and slept elsewhere. Came the time to advance, and in a battlefield is not always a noisy place. There's often, it's very, very quiet. So people coming to and fro and having business, say runners or dispatch riders who need to go about, must know where they are. So just before the front line, they always put a notice, enemy beyond this point. Seems odd, but nevertheless, it was pretty essential, enemy beyond this point. This was always done so that people didn't stray into enemy territory accidentally. And one night, a Bring carrier, I don't know who he was, but he came charging up the road and went straight through this enemy beyond this point because he couldn't see it, and straight into enemy territory, who then fired on him, destroyed the carrier and killed the crew. One of the crew actually was mortally wounded, and he got out and managed to crawl to a tree where he leant against the tree facing back towards us and just died. As we came through the German front line, what had been the German or Italian front line, there he was. You could see him on the left with the burnt out carrier, and his hair had been bleached white with the sun, and his skin was literally as black as coal, as black as that, the case of that recorder. Absolutely black. We went on through the lines because they were retreating quite quickly, the Germans. And we came to a T-junction, and one of our mortar carriers was hit and started to brew up. And ammunition started to go up, so as it was a T-junction, there was no way we could get past it without, you know, it was a dangerous situation. So we had to wait for the carrier to finish blowing up so we could get on. So we lost that one carrier that day. Then went on into the town of Catania, which was one of the main towns in Sicily, only to find that all the people were out on the streets welcoming us. They had huge bottles of wine which were being tipped into our mugs, and handfuls of almonds, and they were rather nice too, actually. And we gradually went through the town, and then all of a sudden it went rather quiet. There were no civilians about. And we came to a bridge, a railway bridge, which had been blown. So one part end of the bridge was dropped into the road underneath, and the other was propped up on the side. And there was a pathway that led from the road leftwards up onto the track. And the track went through a ravine, so there was a high a piece of rock, high rock, that went up about 40 or 50 feet one side, and a smaller piece of rock the other side. So one of our chaps, as we couldn't get through or we didn't think we could get through the bridge, tried getting along the track. And as he went along the track, he tried to turn off, but as he turned, so the rail began to peel his track off, because it was virtually the same width. The rail track was the same width as the carrier track. So We had to leave that because we couldn't move it backwards or forwards, and it had to actually be, eventually it was winched off. So that meant we'd lost two KOs in a day. And just as we were standing on this track, discussing what we were going to do with it, we were spotted by Jerry, and a salvo of 10 shells, I suppose, 10, 12 shells, came over right alongside, between the KO and us, right alongside the track. And I just stood there watching, being a young soldier of all of 18 years old, not really knowing, not having experience this kind of thing. And a young sergeant grabbed hold of my shoulder and said, "Come on, you bloody fool, get there and the cover." So I said, "But they're pitching that over there." Not realising that shrapnel, you know, from the shells can be just as dangerous. Another salvo came over, and there was one civilian with us, a young, handsome Italian civilian with a black flowing moustache, and he was hit by a piece of shrapnel, and he literally was dead before he hit the ground. He twisted so that his ankles were crossed, and then fell on his knees, and then backwards, so his actual heels were right underneath him. No kind of situation where you could do it naturally. So he must have been dead before he hit the ground. We hadn't been there much longer when all of a sudden there was a call from the top of this rock, and that we noticed there was a door there, which was like the rail track maintenance hut for those people. And out came three or four Italian soldiers. Of course, we were all diving for rifles and things like that, you know, thinking we were being attacked. But no, they were giving themselves up. And they, by this time, they'd found a way around the bridge, and off they went. And the platoon officer said to me, being the youngest soldier, "Tony, you look after them." So there were about, I suppose, 10 or 12, but I kept them in the hut. And every time they popped their head out, I pointed my rifle at them, so they kept in. Then some other soldiers started coming along, so I said, "Okay, they're yours." And I went off to join the platoon. I walked down the road. There wasn't a soul about for quite some distance, and an old boy popped his head out of a door of a cottage alongside the road and offered me a glass of wine. And I took it and I drank it because I was so thirsty. I was completely unconcerned. I don't know why I'd be scared to death now, because you didn't know who was, whether a German soldier or company of German soldier could pop it out on you. But nevertheless, I just walked on, and as I turned the corner, there was the mortar platoon all ready for sort of spending the rest of the day there. They had been ordered to halt. And it was on the top of a cliff. The road ran along the top of the cliff. And there was a ship coming into, steaming into Catania Harbour. And there was a German 88 firing at it. And although I must have seen half a dozen or so shots fired at the ship, not one hit it. And it just steamed serenely on and on without we couldn't deviate because it was along the channel, and disappeared from sight quite without any harm coming to it. And chap said, "Cup of tea?" And we had cup of tea, dinner for the evening, and we settled down for the night. And that was my first day in actual active service. I can't imagine a more eventful day, yeah. From seeing one of our chaps killed to the welcoming of the Italians, which was quite surprising because they hadn't up until then been the enemy, and then being fired on by the Germans and the prisoners and the ship being fired at. It was quite an eventful day. We went on, we continued along the coast. That seemed to be our allocated area. And it was some of the most magnificent little coves and villages along there. You'd get a tiny little bay which wasn't much more than 100, 150 yards wide, with steep cliffs either side, and swimming was absolutely an idyllic place. And we went on to a little further, and two of our fellows, we came to a place where there was, they did their farming in terraces. They're quite elaborately done, really, with stone walls and then a level piece where it was filled with earth where the crops were grown, then another level wall and earth where the crops were grown. And along the top of the wall was a channel, which was an irrigation channel, and they had a little rock or slate they used to take out just to irrigate that particular area. And two of our chaps came up with the idea of hanging a biscuit tin, perforated with holes, from the branches of a tree which was growing in these terraces, and then diverting the channel with another biscuit tin which they'd formed into a sort of gutter. So the water went along the gutter into the biscuit tin, and you had a shower. Because baths were not a thing you had much chance to ever have. And of course, say you've got a decent shower, and in cold water, of course, which didn't mind because the weather was very hot anyway. Those two chaps, a few days later, they went on OP, and they were caught on a forward slope of a similar kind of terrace, and the Germans spotted them, and they were firing 88 millimeter shells at them until they got both of them. So they were the first casualties we had of that campaign, from the time I joined them anyway. And then it was a question of not pushing Joey too much, and but just shuffling along behind him until he moved out the way, until we occupied the whole of the island. We didn't fire much after that, not until the end of the campaign in Sicily. It was an idyllic little island. I don't know what it's like now, but I've never been back. But it was quite a beautiful place. Wine was a shilling a bottle, with British military authority money. That was ordinary red wine. Masala was 2 shillings a bottle. So life was quite comparatively cheap, and we had nothing else to spend our money on anyway. So it was after the Germans and Italians had left Sicily. It was just a holiday, really, and with swimming and eating and having wine in the evening. But one day, going down to the beach at a place called Giardini, I think it was, Giardini, I think it was, one section of the rope of the beach was roped off, wired off actually, with the German Achtung, and in English, being put beware of wines and what mines and whatever the Italian is for that. And most people were quite happy with the a bit of beach allocated, and of course we had no bathing costumes, so it was about 200 or 300 British soldiers, absolutely starkers, running around the beach. Three fellas decided that this minefield wasn't really a minefield at all, so they hopped over and walked along the beach, and they hit an S mine. And an S mine is it's not much bigger than a large tin of veg or something like that, probably about 6 inches, 8 inches high, and about as round. It's got a tube comes up and 3 points at the end, and when you touch these points, it explodes a charge and makes the mine jump about 3 or 4 feet into the air, and then it explodes, and it is full of ball bearings. whoever made that mine in Germany really earned its money, because it created a, I thought almost every ball bearing got someone. Must have been about 50, 60 casualties we got from that day. And I was talking to a chap and he said, "Hey Tony, have a look at my back." He said, "There's something's gone in there." And as there was a perfect little hole in his back. So he was carted off to hospital. The chaps who stood on the mine, he actually got exploded near him, and the back of it, the muscle of top of his arm was torn out. So it really created more casualties than it had a right to, you know, because everybody was around there quite happy standing up. So every ball bearing got almost everyone got a target. We hadn't been there long, and it started, we'd all been under canvas, and even our two-man tents, we'd managed to put on long sticks so that we didn't have tent either side, so we could sleep under a tent rather than in a tent. And one night it started to rain, and that was it. We got out, dropped the tents to ground level, and the next day we were put into allocated a billet in a stone house. And from there we were called to a talk by the divisional commander, who said, "You will be going home." And of course everybody was quite chuffed about that. And while we were there, by the way, we used to have concert parties, and what's the name of that chap who got killed in an air crash going over to Paris? Little Brown Jug was one of his...
the American band leader.
American band leader, yeah. Can't remember his name now. But he was killed on his way to Paris. They never even discovered the plane, I don't think. It was only in a little Oster, but he was killed in the war. And then we were shipped off home, and I had my 20th birthday on the ship in Augusta Harbour, waiting to push off. So that was obviously the 19th of October, 1943.
What division had you been in?
The 50th Northumberland Division, 151 Brigade. I did most of my active service in 151 Brigade. I did all my active service in the 9th Battalion, Durham Light Infantry. We came home as a division, and we trained in England as a division as well, ready for Normandy, or what was known then as the Second Front. We knew we'd come home for that. We were told that that was our next job, but we didn't know where it would be in Europe, whether it would be in Normandy or the part of Calais or up in Holland or Norway, come to that. It was all mooted, especially by the Germans, as to where we would land. We had no idea. Training was quite intense while we were there, and we were introduced to a more powerful 3-inch mortar. It was the same 3-inch mortar, but it just had more powerful secondaries on the tail fins of the bombs. We were allowed leave and so on, and I did a special driving course up in Southwold. Not Southwold, more towards Great Yarmouth. And I went on this course about 3 or 4 times for some reason or other, and it was just how to drive into and out of water, because obviously if you're going to going over in a landing craft, you're going to drop into water and come out. And the right speed to go, because otherwise you might get soaked and so on if you created too much of a bow wave. But that was for more or less for soft vehicles rather than armoured vehicles. Anyway, we came back then, and we ended up in between Shirley, just on the edge of Southampton, between Shirley and just outside Shirley, anyway. Our last leave was, we came back, and not long after, we were put in a camp, and it was, the camp was sealed, so we knew that it was pretty imminent. All the brain carriers were given a name, and mine was Amphion. I'll show you a photograph of it in a minute. Mine was called Amphion. They were all named after cruisers. There was Arethusa and so on. And of course, in the mortar platoon, there were seven carriers. One was the commander's carrier, and the other were 6-inch mortars. During the time we were incarcerated in this camp, all completely sealed off, we were treated lavishly. There were plenty of cigarettes, there was plenty of food, there was plenty of cinemas to see or shows, and most important of all, we were told where we would land, not the name, but the area we would land in and what it looked like. So we had sand maps, which showed the contours of the ground from the beachhead onwards for a short distance inland. And you had the actual maps that you would use for going over. And then one night they just said, right, pack up, we're off. And it was the dead of night, and I reversed my carrier down a ramp into a Lanikov tank. And that was it. We were stuck there until the invasion. As soon as the landing craft was loaded, we went off to an anchored out in the Solent somewhere, and we were there for a couple of days. Can't remember being told ever what was going on, but I've heard since there was, of course, a delay of a day in the date of the invasion. Eventually, one afternoon, we're up anchored and off we trundle up the Solent and down round by the Isle of Wight. Just off the Isle of Wight, a mine went up alongside, and it must, when I say alongside, I mean 200 or 300 yards away, I suppose. Hell of an explosion and a big gout of water in the air. And the sailors came along and said, well, we don't think we've done any damage, but we are going to dip the bilges. And they went along dipping the bilges. So we were okay, and off we went in, lying astern with the rest of the convoy of landing craft going over.
Dipping the bilges?
Just in case anything had penetrated the hull, really. And of course, there's two skins: the one that actually supports the carrier, and of course, the one that actually goes through the water.
What happens when a bilge is dipped?
Oh yeah, they just drop a weight with a line attached down a tube into the hull of the ship, and then of course, if it's wet when it comes up, you know you've got trouble. You're not a sailing man?
Nope.
No. Every ship has an area, say, between the outside and the inside where water can accumulate from, say, probably from the propeller shaft. And it all accumulates down there. And you've heard the expression, pumping the bilges. Well, that's it. That's where they're pumping out of, and the pump on most ships are going more or less all the time to keep the ship dry. Nightfall came, and it wasn't a very peaceful night because there were aircraft going over, and there was bangs all over the place. And eventually, we arrived off Gold Beach. We knew we were going to Gold Beach. we knew that Gold Beach was on the left or the west side of Arromanches after where the cliffs dropped down to road level. Lots of noise going on. Lots of fire from Germany, shells and bullets, heavy machine guns, Ehrlichan guns and so on, being fired all over the place. We came across one landing craft assault which had been hit and was just about awash. There were naval craft and small craft whizzing about, and they all had jobs to do, like rescue or whatever happens with naval craft, until eventually we were allocated the beach and we went in to land. The ramp went down. The lieutenant who was in command of our craft said, "Good luck, chaps," and off we went. We went into about 4 foot of water, not very deep at all, 4 or 5 foot of water, I suppose. And we'd waterproof the kayak, which meant putting plates up along the side and in front and behind, and covering the joints with boss sticks. And we've got ashore dry shod. And I turned to Dive Boy and I said, "Any leaks, Dive?" He said, "Just one," he said, and I put my finger over it. So I'd waterproofed the carrier quite well. And off we went to an assembly point, because there was the beach master. He directed everybody to where they had to go, and we went to a little lane just off the beach until we were assembled. There was a company of infantry, 2 3-inch mortars, 2 6-pounder anti-tank guns, 2 Bren gun carriers with Bren guns aboard, and 1 1,500 weight truck. And we got the word and we went off through a place called Mauvaines, I think it is, up towards Rise. And we went just gently along there. Not a shot was fired at us until we'd been on the way about a couple of hours, because obviously it was stop, start all the time, because a company of infantry were on bicycles, by the way, and they had to cover themselves, so they were looking around every corner to see if there's any problem. So we were obviously stop start. And then the RAF, after we'd been going for some time, they spotted us, and there were about 6 aircraft there. And one of them didn't like the look of us, and he peeled off and came around behind us, dropped a bomb and machine gun the whole length of our convoy. Missed everybody. The bomb rode off the 1,500 weight truck, but it missed everybody else. I can remember, even now, I can remember seeing the spurts of that machine gun, 8 machine guns going down the road and just missing me by a matter of feet. That started going now.